Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Senate hearing considering the Time Warner Comcast mega merger and get an assessment of whether monopoly power will trump citizen and consumer opposition from Michael Copps, an FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011, who now heads the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. We will discuss this test case of hypocrisy that exposes champions of the free market in support of monopoly capitalism and see if consumers will stand up to monopolies and force their elected representatives who receive campaign cash from Time Warner and Comcast to act in the interests of their constituents instead of serving their paymasters. Then we will speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter Carlotta Gall, the author of a devastating new book, The Wrong Enemy, America in Afghanistan 2001 to 2014. We will examine her revelations that the head of Pakistan's military intelligence, General Pasha, knew of bin Laden's presence in Pakistan and examine the decades of duplicity by an ally responsible for the deaths of thousands of American and NATO soldiers and the disastrous and dysfunctional relationship the U.S. has with our other so-called ally, the Afghan president, who Obama inherited from Bush, but nevertheless Karzai was allowed to win the rigged 2009 election after having lost the first round. Then finally, we'll look into what is going on behind the scenes at the UN, since the U.S. Senate and now the House have voted overwhelmingly to deny an Iranian diplomat his seat at the UN representing Iran, an appointment the White House has labeled not viable. Former New York Times UN correspondent Barbara Crosset, who now covers the United Nations and writes on international affairs for The Nation, joins us to discuss whether this will lead to the State Department denying Ambassador Abdutalibi a visa to enter this country, a move likely to complicate nuclear negotiations underway and undercut Iran's President Rouhani's authority, since Rouhani is close to this diplomat who has already served as Iran's ambassador to Belgium, the European Union, Italy, and Australia. Joining us now is Michael Copps, who was an FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011 and currently heads the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Copps.
Delighted to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
And yesterday there was a hearing before the Senate on the Comcast-Time Warner merger, and it's pretty hard to believe that the Senate could approve this merger given the rather lame presentation on the part of Comcast. All they can basically say in terms of improving customer service and consumer advantages, all they could say is that they'll have better DVRs. But on the other side, you had 50,000 complaints made to the Federal Trade Commission describing their experiences with the company, particularly Comcast, as being frustrating and nightmarish. You have the consumer magazine, The Consumerist, which is a publication of the Consumer Reports, declaring Comcast the worst company in America. And then you have over 600,000 people having already signed petitions against this merger. So at the end of the day, Michael Copps, will the voices of consumers and citizens be loud enough to overcome the almost record spending and lobbying spending of Comcast on Capitol Hill? Apparently they've spent over $20 million on lobbyists just recently, making them just below Northrop Grumman as the biggest spenders in lobbying on Capitol Hill?
Well, therein is the question, and the answer depends upon how much the Federal Communications Commission hears from people around the country. This is a deal that I believe runs roughshod over consumer choice. It runs roughshod over competition. And it's an affront to the public interest. I think it should have been dead upon arrival. Now, it arrived day before yesterday at the doors of the Department of Justice and the Federal Communications Commission. These are the two agencies that must approve the transaction going forward. The Department of Justice will look at it on antitrust grounds. The Federal Communications will look at it somewhat on competitive grounds, but more importantly on public interest grounds. But how anybody can argue that this deal is in the interest of the American people is beyond me, and you're so right in pointing out that here we're taking two companies that are nowhere near the top of the list of consumer preference and consumer choice, and allowing them to get bigger and control even more of our communications infrastructure. And this isn't just about technology or business plans or even about two companies. This is a merger that will affect the future of the open internet, the future of our democratic dialogue. It's a big time deal, and it cries out to be rejected in my book.
Well, it does appear to be crossing ideological lines in terms of the opposition to this deal. When was the last time that you ever heard that MoveOn.org, Demand Progress, and the National Organization of Women were on the same page and in agreement with the American Family Association, Tea Party Nation, and the U.S. Business and Industry Council?
Well, you know, it can happen, and that's what gives me some optimism here. Back in 2003, shortly after I became a commissioner at the FCC, then Chairman Michael Powell was trying to loosen our media ownership limits so that a very few companies could own more and more broadcast outlets. And I think he and his majority at the commission thought this was just an inside-the-beltway issue. But we went around the country, my Democratic colleague Jonathan Adelstein and myself, talked to people, worked with groups like Common Cause and Free Press and senators and congressmen who opposed those deals, and 3 million people thereupon wrote in to the FCC and to Congress, and the Senate proceeded to disapprove of those rules, reject those rules, overturn them, and the House disapproved in somewhat different language, and then the court sent them back anyhow. But it does show that citizen action can still make a difference. And as we went around the country, it was clear to me this was not a red state and a blue state issue out amongst average Americans. In Washington, these things can get pretty politicized. But back then, we had liberal groups and conservative groups supporting us against Chairman Powell, and that worked, and I think that can work again here. I certainly hope so, but it's a steep cliff. It's an uphill battle because these are powerful, well-entrenched, and well-financed companies.
Well, while you and your colleague Adelstein were going around the country talking to people and getting feedback from consumers and citizens, Chairman Powell was flying around in Time Warner's jet. And my sense is that it was his decision as chairman of the FCC that basically was the fatal one, and I know you opposed it, and that is how the FCC classified broadband.
Absolutely, and this is an issue that gets very quickly in the weeds, but just to make a long and complicated story as simple as I can, to me, and I think to most right-thinking people at the time, broadband is an advanced telecommunication service, and advanced telecommunication services generally are regulated in something called Title II of the Communications Act. What the Powell Commission proceeded to do was to put cable modem and then later on telecom Internet II under a different part of the statute, Title I, where there were no guaranteed consumer protections. There were no guarantees of reasonable and comparable services and reasonable prices and emergency calling and public safety and all of that. So they call broadband something other than telecommunications when it wasn't. And that put us on a really awful course that we're still suffering from today.
Well, yesterday NPR had a very softball interview with Michael Powell asking about what happened back then and why it was that the U.S. took this path that has led to monopolies. But at the time, Michael Powell was arguing that this would lead to competition. And it's clearly had the result of the reverse, because this merger will basically give this new company, Time Warner Comcast, a monopoly over about up. It could grow up very quickly up to 50% of all American consumers. And it was pretty shocking how now Michael Powell, of course, is a lobbyist for these very same cable companies.
That's the revolving door of Washington D.C.
Well, so in other words, the way to stop the revolving door is for citizens to get so angered that they're going to jam their foot in the door, right?
Well, it is. And let me just add, you know, on this argument about competition, it's just so ludicrous to me that these companies can say, well, this is not anti-competitive because we're not competing against one another in specific markets. But what's at issue here is you're taking the huge footprint of Comcast, which is distribution and content. It's broadband and broadcast because they, you know, they own NBC Universal. It's horizontal and vertical control, and you're taking this from a huge part of the country where it already exists and implanting it on another huge part of the country. How that can be deemed pro-competitive in anybody's book is simply beyond my ability to understand.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Copps, who was an FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011 and currently heads the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. So at least the Senate got an earful from consumers and from competitors. There was a fellow representing a Golf Channel that can't get his channel on because basically these monopolies can write the rules of the road, and unless you can pay them a fortune, you're not going to get your channel in their mix, or you're not going to get your program on their channels. And that we saw here in recently this spat between Time Warner and CBS, which was a sort of inside corporate boardroom brinksmanship. They didn't give a damn about the consumer. They just kept fighting it out in this kind of nose-to-nose, you know, corporate tough guy battle. And, you know, they lost a lot of customers as a result. But the arrogance of these people was that the last person they cared about was the consumer, who was suddenly shut out. They didn't offer any compensation for the fact that you couldn't get people who watch CBS couldn't get their favorite shows, and they only came back on when the football games began.
Right. You know. But I want your listeners to really understand what a steep climb this is, because we are talking here, as you indicated at the outset, about a company with vast resources to amass armies of lobbyists and lawyers and spend wheelbarrows full of money on getting what they want. And this is an era that we live in, as I don't have to tell you, where special interests and big money control power almost unparalleled in our history, going back to the Gilded Age of the 1880s and the 1890s. So to counteract that and to overcome that is going to be a tremendous doing. We have a lot of the public interest groups here in Washington, D.C. and around the country who are against the deal. They are doing their dead level best to make their opposition felt and to build public support for it. But I think that people really, if they feel strongly about this, and I hope they do, they really need to make their voices heard. We have a new chairman at the Federal Communications Commission, and I think he really needs to know how the American people feel about this particular merger.
Well, it would seem that Al Franken's got a petition going, and there's also this other petition that has gotten 500,000 signatures so far. Mm-hmm. So there are places to go. What would your recommendation be to some of our outraged listeners out there who basically want to stop this monopoly from giving even more expensive and even worse service?
Well, I think the best place to start is to let the Federal Communications Commission know how they feel. The commission isn't supposed to be a weather vane and pass something just because they get letters for it, but in point of fact, in the real world in which we live, they're supposed to be listening to the American people. Goodness knows the big companies and the special interests have a pretty easy entree into the commission. I think the commission is doing a better job now than it has sometimes in the past in listening to people, but this has to be a good and forceful message so that the commission understands this is something that is important to people. This is something that, if approved, will harm consumers and harm competition. And because it involves not just cable, but it involves the future of the Internet, because you're talking about this huge broadband distributor, it is really important. If you want to cableize the Internet, who better to do it than the biggest cable country in the United States of America? But I think most people don't want an Internet that looks like their cable system. I think they want to have open access, and they don't want companies with the power to gatekeep and to exact high tolls and to block content and all the rest. But that seems to be the way we're heading with the Internet right now.
Well, Michael Copps, what was disturbing about this hearing yesterday in the Senate, even though the representative from Comcast, Mr. Cohen, really took a drubbing, and people were pointing out that there's one instance where somebody witnessed a crime across the street but couldn't call the police because their Comcast phone doesn't work. And they were even told by the Comcast technician that, forget about our phone service, it just doesn't work. You know, I mean, when you got that one pipe into your house, you don't have any choice, obviously. So he takes a drubbing, but then at the end of this hearing, after Senator Al Franken had walked out and he'd finished his testimony, Cohen, got up from his witness chair and went across and started glad-handing members and staffers of the Senate Judiciary Committee, where it was all sort of cozy and hunky-dory all of a sudden. So there's the disconnect there. And is it possible then that the fact that it's not just people on the left and liberals and progressives that are outraged by this, but the fact that sort of Tea Party people and pro-business, but more conservative and right-wing organizations also oppose it, do you think that's a good tactic, that maybe some of the Republicans who support it and some of the Democrats who support it in the name of this false belief in competition will be shamed by the fact that this is against all of the tenets of capitalism and competition that they continually promote? And, you know, it's basically a monopoly and an arrogant and dismissive one at that.
Yeah, well, I think you mentioned the disconnect. I think in another way it shows the connect between these special interests and the powers that be. But Mr. Cohen is a very effective representative of this company, a very effective lobbyist. I hope that this kind of a coalition can be built. As I said, I think around the country it's not a Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal deal. But what's, in this country we decided long ago, for better or not, that communications, broadcast, and all the rest was going to be very much a part of the capitalist system. And we all expect that good business people will work to build their companies and to gain power. But what we don't believe in, certainly for the last 100 years, is the fact that you can let somebody achieve monopoly power and then be bereft of public oversight and be bereft of regulation. But that's what these big companies, that's what Comcast and Verizon and AT&T, and I think increasingly even some of the companies on the Internet itself, are going. This is the kind of world they're working for, and they're having a lot of success, not just at the federal level, but at the state level right now. You know, these companies have gone around. There are now 20 states where you can't build, or it's very difficult to build, a municipal broadband system. Even if the big companies don't want to come in and serve a community that might be trying to get this all-important 21st century infrastructure built, they get laws passed in the state capitals that preclude that. And that's all kind of underneath the radar, because we don't have the kind of deep-dive journalism we used to have and investigative reporting. And all of a sudden we wake up one morning and find that, lo and behold, people can't build their own broadband when the big companies don't want them to. So it's a serious, serious problem. This is the essential infrastructure of the 21st century. If we're all going to find jobs and educate ourselves and take care of our health and open wider the doors of opportunity, should be a golden age of communications right now. Instead, because of all of this consolidation that we've had over the years, and also because of the, I think, dereliction of duty of the Federal Communications Commission for many, many years, particularly 2001 up through 2008, we're headed in the wrong direction, and we've got to make sure now that this new commission, and it has it hadn't done such a great job from 2009 up until now on some of these questions, open internet and media consolidation. We got to get that agency back attending to the public interest. That's supposed to be its job.
Well, Michael Powell, I think, God, what a mental slip. Well, Michael Copps, I thank you very much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be on, and thank you for covering this very important issue.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Copps, who was an FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011, and he currently heads the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the former UN correspondent for The New York Times, Barbara Crosset, about the unviable Iranian ambassador who the House and Senate are blocking, and the president might well sign a bill that will create a tremendous division between the U.S. and Iran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Barbara Crosset, who is a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent at The Nation magazine and author of several books on Asia. She was the New York Times chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia from 1984 to 1991, and has also been a diplomatic correspondent in Washington and a reporter in Central America, the Caribbean, and Canada, as well as the Times bureau chief at the United Nations. Barbara, the UN, of course, both the U.S. Senate and the House have voted overwhelmingly to deny an Iranian diplomat a seat on the UN representing Iran. And this appointment, the White House has already labeled as not viable. So if we get to the point where the State Department denies Ambassador Aboutaleb a visa to enter this country, and presumably all that will take now is the president's signature on this bill, isn't this likely to complicate nuclear negotiations underway with Iran and also undercut Iran's President Rouhani's authority, since Rouhani is close to this diplomat who, by the way, has already been Iran's ambassador to Belgium, the European Union, Italy, and Australia?
Well, yes, the first part of your question first, which is that, one can look at it this way. Whether it undercuts the talks going on in Geneva now between an Iranian delegation and a Western delegation, Europeans and Americans, it also raises the question of whether this is exactly what the people who have pushed this bill want. Many of them apparently, what I can't explain is why it was unanimous, or that is to say bipartisan, in the Senate. But it is sort of one of the new ways of attacking Obama's foreign policy by trying to scuttle this arrangement with Iran and go back to a more confrontational stance. So, yes, it will complicate things, maybe. However, it all depends on whether the Iranians react in a negative way. They have obviously criticized these moves in Congress, and they will be criticizing it even more if the president signs on to this. But that's not certain yet. And it'll be a test, really, of the Iranians also, how much they want to keep these talks moving. as much as it will be a test of how Obama plays this if he's forced into signing it.
Well, there's been some rumors for some time that the supreme leader in Iran has given Rouhani a very short leash, and that he only allowed him to win the election because of the overwhelming public support for Rouhani. So is there any sense or any evidence of what games are being played on the Iranian side? Clearly, this situation has been created by the hawks in the Senate and the House, who have wanted to scuttle this deal from the beginning. And AIPAC, the Israeli lobby, have made a tremendous effort to push through a bill to basically scuttle their talks. So far, the White House has managed to hold off that attack. But this looks like just a backdoor attack that they found. We can get into the issue about what's happening in terms of Americans sabotaging this deal. But do you think there are people in Iran who also want to sabotage the deal?
I think there are, and I'm obviously not reporting from there, so I'm not an expert at all. But it's certainly well known among all the experts in this country and the reporting coming out of Iran that it's a tentative situation there as well. That there is, every once in a while, the Ayatollah Khamenei weighs in with some extremely intemperate blast against the West and America in general. What I don't think everybody is totally clear about now is whether this was Rouhani's appointment alone or whether he was given the go-ahead to do it, which is probably more likely given the situation. But again, some of these things are not well known because there isn't really much known about because the Iranians don't allow a lot of free reporting. There's not that much known about exactly where the seesaw is tipping right now. So this if this plays out with an American rejection of the Iranians' visa, we'll see whether it's viewed as a triumphant victory for the hardliners, or we told you so kind of thing, or whether the Iranians can handle this in a way that doesn't. That doesn't damage Rouhani, and I think it's everybody here is kind of in a tentative position.
So, Barbara Crissett, in terms of the UN that you cover, what do people around the UN think of this? I mean, we were just waiting to have Carlotta Gall on before you, and for some reason or other, we haven't been able to get her. And she's written a book about a country, Pakistan, that's an ally that we've given about $30 billion to since 9/11. And they're responsible for the death of 2,300 Americans in Afghanistan and another 1,000 NATO troops. The book reveals that they've been harboring the world's number one terrorist, Osama bin Laden, that the head of the ISI knew was in the place where the SEAL Team 6 eventually found him and killed him. If that's not a country or a government that's in bed with terrorists, I don't know what is. But the charge against this guy is, and this is what the House and the Senate have voted on, is that he's a terrorist and he has to be denied entry. I mean, we're not denying entry to Pakistani diplomats, but we're denying entry to this guy based upon the fact, apparently, that he translated for the hostages who took over the U.S. Embassy back in 1979.
Yeah, there are a lot of other diplomats and including some former American diplomats who see nothing wrong in them. This is why it seems quite obvious that this is a blown up, a stunt, if you want, or a campaign, to further undercut Obama and to make the point that the U.S. shouldn't be talking to Iran at all. It's a different thing for one person, of course, to have been in a group of students, the pictures of him at the time of, not at the time of the takeover. He was brought in to handle press conferences. He's a linguist. I mean, he's a He's well trained to be a diplomat, apart from his experience subsequently. They just hooked onto this, taking a piece out of history and making it, blowing it up into a big issue. But this doesn't mean Iran as a country hasn't support. I mean, we know about Iran's support of Hezbollah, of other organizations around the region, and we know that the Iranians are not trusted as a nation. This is a different thing, and it puts it in another context. The Saudis and we know about Israel. There are other countries around the region that are very wary of Iran for its ties with terrorism. So if it comes to the United Nations as an issue, Iranians aren't going to have as many friends as one might think they'd have. There's not going to be the level, I don't think, of a criticism of the United States. It will be fought on legal grounds. This is to say, has the United States broken an agreement with the United Nations dating back into the 1947, I think, that they cannot deny visas to representatives of foreign governments because the UN is international territory. So that's more or less where I think the fighting will come down. I mean, the criticism, the debate, and all that. And it will have to be in the General Assembly. The U.S. will never let anything happen in the Security Council.
Well, it does seem that the examples have been pretty obvious for some time that the U.S. Hasn't gone to the mat, and they haven't objected to Yasser Arafat addressing the U.N. with a pistol strapped to his hip, Castro of Cuba, and the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. There is, I believe, some evidence was there that there was one person that was denied entry. An Iranian diplomat, I meant to say.
Yeah, there was one. I mean, diplomats are sometimes defined as persona non grata and sent out, or they're denied visas. I mean, there are two levels here. A lot of those people you just mentioned are heads of state, heads of government. That's a different thing from being a potential ambassador. And the Iranians, I was just reading somewhere, have not really pushed this hard yet. This has been discussed for, I think, several months now. The rumor was that this was the man who was going to be named and that they were not expecting this. I don't know that it was considered, that this nomination was considered a provocation. I mean, some people have made that charge. But people in the diplomatic world who know the situation just disprove that. They think that this just came out of left field in the U.S. Congress. Never mind that. The point is, yes, Arafat was denied a visa to speak. He's not a head of state or government, was not at the time, and the Palestinians had a lower observer status than they do now, and the United Nations moved the entire General Assembly to Geneva in 1988, and they had their meeting there, and he spoke there. So that was clearly outrageous opinionated word, but it was a case where the whole General Assembly had to decamp to Geneva to avoid or to show their displeasure at an American veto of a visa. Now, last year, the president of Sudan, who is wanted by the International Criminal Court for what he did in Darfur and other things, they delayed his visa. They never denied it to come to speak in the General Assembly. He is a president of a country. I think the U.S. has been pretty good on the heads of state. Some of them don't come here because they're afraid of in the case of Omar Bashir from Sudan, of some kind of an arrest and being shipped off to the International Criminal Court. Not by Americans necessarily, because the U.S. doesn't belong to the court. But, there have been others who are afraid to come up to New York for fear of demonstrations, protests, perhaps even violence. And they stay away because that's what they decide. Whereas in this case, it's just an ambassador. It's not a head of government.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Barbara Cassett, who's a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent at The Nation magazine and author of several books on Asia. She was a New York Times chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia from 1984 to 1991 and has also been a diplomatic correspondent in Washington and a reporter in Central America, the Caribbean, and Canada, as well as the Times bureau chief at the UN. So the double standard, though, appears to be here in terms of the actual what they're trying to pin on this guy as being a terrorist because he was a translator for the students who took over the U.S. embassy back in 1979 in Tehran. And the L.A. Times, for example, in an editorial titled "Iran's UN Envoy Isn't a Threat," pointed out that as a young leftist in 1970 West Germany, Joschka Fischer took part in violent street demonstrations and was photographed attacking a policeman. But decades later, he served as foreign minister of United Germany. What is are the UN community sort of pointing out this double standard? Or
Well, no, I don't. I think everybody understands what it is. Yeah. Joschka Fischer was not attacking the American embassy. They have seized on this. They kept fanning this thing. If you go back to square one, which is what you did at the beginning, they just don't want the U.S. to open any kind of serious relations with Iran. And so this came along, you know, sort of like manna from heaven, where they could grab this little thing and run with it. And in any other less partisan situation, the long-term interests of the United States would be to talk Iran down from its nuclear position, rather than raise the level of confrontation. The Mideast and West Asia are already in such turmoil, and because of a whole lot of things. So, you know, I don't know about double standard. I just think that this was just a unique opportunity to go after the president. Now, as I said earlier, what is distressing from an outsider's point of view about partisanship is that Democrats would go along with this. And whether this shows that the Democrats are also not happy with the Iranian policy, whether they're not happy with Obama, the Democrats who let this thing just go through, you know, sort of automatically and today through the House of Representatives, is another question. And that one is not really getting examined enough.
But Barbara Cassett, President Obama is not the only president that's going to be have egg on his face or be humiliated in this situation. What about President Rouhani? This ambassador is a close friend and a protege of Rouhani's. So doesn't it undercut his authority to deny his choice as an ambassador to represent Iran at the United Nations?
Well, you'd have to go a step beyond and say, really, does it undercut his position at home? That's one thing. But is he going to allow this to affect the way he deals with the United States? And that's, in the great long scheme of history, that's the more important decision. And that's going to be a difficult decision for him. Now, if the U.S. denies a visa, whether he then gets pushed very hard by the hardliners, that's another story. But for Rouhani, it would be a blow, and it would be, quite frankly, judging from what diplomats are saying, a completely unfair blow. But that's what was intended, I think, in Washington. But anyway, it would be an unfair blow, but then it puts huge, huge emphasis on Rouhani and how he now maneuvers either out of this or whatever, but he seems to be intent on carrying on these negotiations. And in Geneva today, you know, people were trying to play down this, you know, that this wasn't going to derail the talks. They have a few more months. They were working on a final document, or at least a semi-final document. And so it puts him in a very, very tenuous situation. Obviously, much more than it would do for Obama, because Obama and John Kerry will just carry on with their policy if they can. But Rouhani is going to have to make some very difficult decisions if this visa ban goes through. I think. And, you know, just go back to one other thing, double standards. You know, there was a huge outpouring against the Shah of Iran when he wanted to come to the U.S. for medical treatment, you'll remember. He did, actually, was allowed, and then he was basically denied entry into the United States, and he died more or less in complete opprobrium. The American people were completely against, or at least more or less against that. So it's not just, you know, they were against the Shah, then they were against the people who took over after the Shah. The public opinion here has fluctuated, and it isn't always logical, depending on the feeling of the moment. And I think now with so much turmoil going on in Syria and of course North Africa, which is a distant, but in Lebanon now under threat with Hezbollah and other places in the region, it's a different situation now than it was then, and people are very wary of giving Iran any more room to you know, threaten the neighbors. Today, there was the other day a long piece about their, what we're not looking at is their missile systems. I mean, forget for the moment the nuclear warheads, but they've got thousands of missiles. Now, you know, you have to, you know, sort of walk it back like they did with Russia when the days were better. You know, start limiting all kinds of armaments if that's possible. But anyway, I think Rouhani has got a big problem.
Well, Barbara Crosetto, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Barbara Crosetto, who's a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent at The Nation magazine and author of several books on Asia. She was the New York Times chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia from 1984 to 1991, and has also been a diplomatic correspondent in Washington and a reporter in Central America, the Caribbean, and Canada, as well as the Times bureau chief at the United Nations. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the issues raised in this devastating new book, The Wrong Enemy, America in Afghanistan, 2001 to 2014.
On the چشمان مست سیاحت مبند نازنین نازداری به موی کمند از اول جلوه ها می کنی صد هزار پس بگو جلوه هایت فروشی و چند
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Oh, thank you for having me again.
And thank you for coming on, Chris, because obviously something happened with Coletta Gall and a devastating new book, The Wrong Enemy, America in Afghanistan, 2001-2014, does bring out the headlines came from that book was that the head of Pakistan's military intelligence, General Pasha, knew of bin Laden's presence in Pakistan. And apparently there was a special desk, the bin Laden desk, secretly set up at the ISI. What's your understanding of and the sourcing on that?
So, look, I have a lot of respect for Carlotta Gall. I mean, her work is simply unparalleled in terms of the time on the ground, the quality of the rigor, and quite frankly, the ballsiness of her work. So I have great respect and admiration for her. On this point, however, I am quite dubious that this went up to Pasha. I think if I were bin Laden or if you were bin Laden, you wouldn't want DGISI knowing about this because you could never know how reliable the successor will be. They could sell you if the price was right. So you would just never know from your own operational security if you could rely upon the DJISI. I think there's a different explanation, and that is that Pakistan has many blackwaters. It has multiple networks of retired intelligence operatives, retired military personnel, and they use these blackwater-like contractors in the same way that we do. So it's entirely possible that one of these blackwater-like networks were in charge of overseeing bin Laden. And this would make sense. So if any question came up within the military intelligence or the ISI or even the intelligence bureau or the special branch of the police, it would eventually get bounced back to, oh yeah, this particular Blackwater is handling that house. Don't worry about it. That makes more sense to me than this idea that there was a desk to handle bin Laden at the ISI. I'm very skeptical of that claim.
But in general, though, in terms of a country that has received $30 billion or close to $30 billion of U.S. aid since 9/11, that basically has state-sponsored terrorism under a nuclear umbrella, and yet somehow, and by the way, is responsible for the deaths of, largely responsible to my mind at least, of the deaths of 2,300 Americans and 1,000 NATO soldiers in Afghanistan. We treat that country as though it's an ally, and their diplomats and their ISI people over here are given visas. Here we are, as we pointed out in the earlier interview about this UN denying this Iranian diplomat a UN because the House and Senate are calling him a terrorist because he translated for the students who took over the U.S. Embassy back in 1979. So isn't that a glaring double standard? I mean, you know.
Oh, Ian, you and I have violently agreed on this over the last, 11 years. You know, I often ask my students in class, let's do a counterfactual. In 2001, Khatami was the president of Iran. He was incredibly supportive of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. At Bonn, which is where the interim constitution was drafted for Karzai, it was the Iranian representative that insisted upon democracy. And, of course, how Iran was rewarded for this was being included in the Axis of Evil speech. If we could go back to 2001, and if we could have capitalized upon what Khatami was proposing, and if we had worked with Iran to move logistics through the Chabahar port and the lines of control that the Indians had already built linking Chabahar to Afghanistan, we'd be in a different place. But when you suggest this, people go ballistic, and they say, well, Iran is a nuclear proliferator and it supports terrorism. Bullocks. There is no amount of terrorism and no amount of proliferation that Iran has done that Pakistan hasn't done more of. And to your point, I was actually just at the State Department today, and I asked them the same question, Ian. I said, $30 billion later, they are responsible for our troops dying in Afghanistan, both to the Taliban and groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba. Why are they not declared a state that sponsors terrorism? Instead, they're completely feted here. And, you know, and there's a lot of suspicion, and I would say our views are shared by many within the intelligence community, parts of DOD, but the State Department is where all of this pro-Pakistani sentiment lies. And it is absolutely enraging. And I'm grateful that you've brought out this point that $30 billion later, they're the ones killing our troops, not Al-Qaeda. But I think the average American doesn't understand this.
So why then do you think we can't call it as it is? I mean, you think it is the State Department? I mean, and surely Obama, you know, who obviously, at least if you believe the White House's narrative, recognized that he couldn't let the Pakistanis know that they were going to invade their airspace and grab bin Laden. Unlike Bush before him, who would just get on the phone and talk to Musharraf, and probably would have telegraphed the raid had he been in the White House. So, and of course, then bin Laden would have been mysteriously whisked away, as happened earlier when the cruise missiles came into his hideout in Afghanistan after 9/11. So, what's your understanding of this extraordinary denial that goes on in the face of overwhelming evidence?
So I think it really comes down to Pakistan's nuclear weapons program. So basically, Pakistan holds the whole world hostage because of its nuclear weapons and its threat, its constant threat to proliferate, both to other countries, as it did in the 90s, of course, to Iran most prominently, but most specifically, proliferating within its own program. It has been very vocal that it is pursuing what they'll call battlefield nuclear weapons, which are essentially what we would call tactical nuclear weapons. And this raises all sorts of concerns about command and control. Will terrorists get a hold of these small nuclear weapons? Because, in fact, once they're out in the field, they become much more difficult to control. And the Pakistanis know this, and the Pakistanis know that we know this. And so they basically manipulate this fear so that the Americans will want to continue to have a large presence in Afghanistan, a large presence in Pakistan. And to have a large presence justified, you have to, with, you know, spies in the embassy, you have to have a large aid program. And so a lot of this comes down to the American inability to find some way of extricating itself from this coercion loop. And I think there's also organizations like USAID, which have really benefited from this nonsensical narrative that terrorists are poor and they're uneducated. And if we just, you know, lift them out of poverty and educate them, they'll be less vulnerable to terrorism. USAID has benefited tremendously from this narrative. Its programming in Pakistan is bloated, it's oversized, it's unproductive, it contributes to massive corruption. And so you have on the inside several organizations that really benefit directly from this narrative of trying to keep the Pakistanis in game. And so I think that's a relatively long-winded answer for why the State Department is constantly going to Congress and trying to get Congress to appropriate larger amounts, resist cutting Pakistan off altogether. Secretary Kerry very quietly and surreptitiously sought a waiver on Pakistan's security requirements to get Kerry Lugar Berman monies. Not a single American newspaper reported on it. That's how quiet they were about it. The only paper that picked up on it was an Indian newspaper.
Again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. So just turning to the other disastrous and dysfunctional relationship that the U.S. has with the other of our so-called allies, the Afghan president, Karzai, who Obama inherited from Bush. But nevertheless, Karzai was allowed to win the rigged 2009 election after having lost the first round. And in Carlotta Gall's new book, The Wrong Enemy, she points out that when Karzai was forced to admit he had failed to win the first round of the elections, she apparently was there when he got the news, and she was there with John Kerry, who was then head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Quoting her book, "I watched Karzai's face that day in private with John Kerry. I knew he would not forgive America for the humiliation." What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, it's truthful. But, you know, I was watching this election. I was there as an election observer in 2009, and I had been there a number of times previous to that. And what's probably important to note is that the Bush administration was engaging in a whole series of activities that directly contributed to Karzai's rigging that election. Karzai had set up this thing called the Independent Local Governance Directorate, and this was directly funded by USAID. The IDLG was a mechanism that Karzai used to put into place district and provincial officials that would be pivotal to rigging his election. When Obama won the presidency and realized that this election was already, that the train had sailed on this election being rigged, there really wasn't much that could be done about it. And so if you were Karzai, you could be a little bit surprised that, you know, the previous administration went so far as to help you rig your election. And now you've got this guy, Obama, who's basically dragging you behind the bus. Obama, you know, came out of the box really disliking Karzai. And his reasons for disliking him were quite legitimate. You know, if you believe all the counterinsurgency rubbish that's been sold around this town, by the way, I don't, you know, it was very clear that you simply can't win with a partner that's running this corrupt, kleptonarcocracy.
Well, but I know you don't get do-overs in foreign relations, but it would seem to me that this would be the ultimate do-over. If Ambassador Peter Galbraith was fired by his boss, the head of the UN, who decided to side with Karzai against Peter Galbraith in calling it the election the fraud that it was and having a second round, which Abdullah apparently had won the first round at any rate. He's the guy that's perhaps the front runner now. Wouldn't we have had a whole different situation? You couldn't have done worse than Karzai, right?
Well, look, so we can blame Karzai for many, many things, but I'm going to go back to some other fundamental points. Much of the corruption that we blame Karzai for, we created. So I don't know if you were following some reporting that came out a few months ago. There were some documents that were leaked that the Zalmay Khalilzad embassy had been paying several of Karzai's NSC staffers a completely illegal additional salary from the U.S. government so that we could basically be spying on Karzai. All of these contracts that we have at these, to run the provincial reconstruction teams, this was just corruption on a stick. We were throwing money at what we called strongmen. If we didn't like them, they were warlords. So a lot of this corruption that we blame Karzai for, I think, has a lot to do with how the international community, through each of their own domestic incentives and preferences, wanted to shove money through this country that couldn't handle it. So I think what we're really experiencing is obviously his own personal ineptitude, but also we're experiencing the consequences of our own ineptitude. Like, let's take USAID, for example. So we can look at the outright numbers that USAID has so-called allocated to Afghanistan. 90 cents per dollar is estimated to have come back to the United States in contractor fees.
Oh, that's an outrage.
It's a total outrage.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here.
Hey, great. Have a great night. Bye-bye.
You too. Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.